Good evening. Most of you, I think, know me, but some of you may not. So just to introduce myself, I'm Paul Wilkins, the acting university librarian and also the secretary of the Friends of the Library. But right up front, I'm doing this because I've got an apology from our president, Jane Lomax-Smith. She hopes she may be able to join us at some point in the evening. Oh, she's here! Wonderful! Well, I think I'll probably ask her if she could take over, because I know she's very keenly... All right. Well, we're very pleased to see you, Jane. So, I thought I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses at North Terrace, Waite, Theberton and Roseworthy are built. Now, this evening has been looked forward to, obviously, by you and myself, because this is a rather special event in our programme to offer something which helps to... commemorate rather than celebrate, I guess, the anniversaries of the First World War battles, the Somme and Fromelles particularly. And we're very, very pleased that we've got three of the authors of this very special book, Blood, Sweat and Fears, Medical Practitioners and Medical Students of South Australia who served in World War One. So I believe Christopher Verco is going to actually present, but we're very pleased to have three of the authors here. Annette Summers and Michael Jelly are sitting here in the front row, so welcome. The fourth author, yes, thank you. And the fourth author, Tony Swain, I believe is interstate or overseas and can't join us. So I think without further ado, I will hand over to Christopher, but I think some of you know that Christopher's had a very significant career in medicine as a consultant and senior lecturer in obstetrics and gynaecology at Flinders Medical Centre, and he's also had some experience, I gather, as a group captain in the RAAF Specialist Reserve. So combination of experiences that perhaps feed into his interest in this sort of book. So thank you, Christopher, and we look forward to your presentation.
I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Jane, for inviting us to talk about our book this evening. The talk really is based on the book. I know some of you have bought a book, and that's enormously kind of you, but the objective from our perspective this evening is not to flog books, because we reckon we're doing okay on that score, but really to share with you the knowledge that's in the book and perhaps excite you to read it, having purchased it. Now, my co-authors are here. Dr. Swain sends his apologies. We're all part of a group called the Army Health Services Historical Research Group. That's a group that was formed in Adelaide by Colonel Bruce Perks, who's an anaesthetist, in 2007. We have a meeting once a month at the Naval and Military Club. The meeting lasts an hour. The Army, in their inimitable style, take minutes and notes, and then we have dinner. And some years ago, that group, which used to get on quite well together, the temperature changed from a modest temperature like tonight to about minus a million degrees in about 3 seconds, where a couple of members of the group said, all we ever do is meet every month, have a meeting, and then have dinner. Well, as far as I was concerned, that was just fine. But nevertheless, when the temperature changes, you have to think of doing something. And indeed we did. We came up with a concept, which I'll go into in a minute, but it's resulted in this book, Blood, Sweat and Fears, Medical Practitioners and Medical Students of South Australia who served in World War One. Me, Annette Summers, Tony Swain and Michael Jelly are the co-authors. The book was published at the beginning of August in 2014 and launched by His Excellency the Governor, Rear Admiral Kevin Scarce. The book is really a biographical dictionary of those medical students, medical practitioners of South Australia who served in World War One. The small university produced, and they're on the roll of honour at the front of in the Mitchell Building, four medical graduates who were killed in World War One and one medical student who was killed in World War One. And the role of service lists 13 medical members of staff, 96 medical graduates and 10 medical students, all who served in the armed forces in World War One. In our endeavours, we've been helped enormously by the archives, records and collections part of the U of A. They really don't have a lot of material, but what they've got is fantastic, and I'll come into bits of it later on. And we're grateful that Andrew Cook and Sue Coppin have been an enormous help to us. Our somewhat enigmatic title is our imagination of what it was like on HMAS Sydney. You can see this probably comes from the Navy member of the group, Tony Swain. Leonard Dalby wrote a report on the action between HMAS Sydney and the Emden in November 1914. They set up two operating theatres on the Sydney in the Stoker's bathrooms. They were 10 feet by 8 feet by 7 feet, and that's where we get our blood, sweat and fears from, because we imagine that was the environment in which they were working. So in April 2011, after this sort of exciting dinner, we produced a project, and the project was to document the South Australian medical practitioners and medical students who served in World War One, each in a one-page biography, and publish a booklet of these by June 2014. I thought there'd be about 50 of these people, and I would know about half of them, or know of half of them, and it would be a bit of a doddle. It turns out that we have 203 one-page biographies in the book that some of you have purchased, and each of them have stuck to our formula. So to get into the book, you had to be South Australian before World War I, you had to be a medical practitioner or a medical student, and you had to have served in the military forces of the Grand Alliance, because a number of our people served in the British forces. So those are the ones who were in. And of course, our book was published on time. And as I say, we have 203 one-page biographies. Our aim, and it's particularly apposite when we have this week in which we commemorate the battles of Fromelles, the start of the Battle of Pozieres, with huge loss of life on all sides, but particularly Australian life. We felt it was important to create a picture of the people who were involved. And so each one-page biography comprises three paragraphs. A paragraph of what you did before you went away, a paragraph of what you did whilst you're away, and a paragraph of what you did when you came back. So that in some way you get a picture of the whole person, not just a whole series of, you know, an operation here and blowing up somebody there. So that we wanted to create that impression. Where we couldn't fill a whole page, rather than jamming people into another page, so we had two people on the same page, we stuck to our guns, one page per person in alphabetical order, and where we couldn't fill the whole page, we filled in with a paragraph or two which we'd taken out of the British Medical Journal, the diaries of some of our doctors who had landed at Gallipoli on the original Anzac Day, and from other sources, again just to build up a picture of what it was like at the time. Now, why might we want to do it? And this is a reference from Colonel Butler, who published the Australian Army Medical Corps in World War One, the official history, published in 1943. If Anderson Stewart made the Sydney graduate the most enterprising and worldly wise, H.B. Allen made the Melbourne student a student for life, and Joseph Furco impressed on the Adelaide School, so he gets more lines, Adelaide School a fervour and scientific outlook and a professional standard which enabled the South Australian Assembly to lead the way. This is the third medical school here, and it was the smallest, and yet we, in Butler's opinion, and Butler was there at Gallipoli and was decorated with a DSO, Butler's opinion, the Adelaide group certainly did well and were not seen to be wanting. The other reasons we might want to do this is that a number of our people were actually very highly decorated. For those of us in the military, we know that a companion of the Distinguished Service Order is second only to a Victoria Cross. There's only ever been one Victoria Cross in the Australian Army Medical Service, and that was in the Boer War. So these South Australians were decorated with a DSO, and some of them, in my opinion, got the wrong decoration. For example, Lou Jeffries, who was decorated with a DSO for carrying the wounded out under fire on his back. And that is exactly what Howe's got a Victoria Cross for. So I reckon some of our people were dudded. And I think that applies to others. Burston treated the injured during a gas attack. You can imagine how crappy a gas mask is after the first 2 minutes. Well, he did it for 24 hours. So these are very distinguished people, Fry, who we'll come on to later, and Lemessurier, again, organising the evacuation of the wounded under fire. 20 of them, or 19 of them, were decorated with a military cross or military medal. Steele, of course, got a bar to his military cross, and again, the next one down from a DSO, so VC, DSO, MC. Phoebe Chappell was decorated with a military medal because she wasn't an officer. And as we go through these, you may recognise some of the names. When they came back from World War I, a number of them were to be highly distinguished in their civilian lives. And I'll come on to some of these again in a minute, but once more, you might recognise some names there. In my particular discipline, there's obviously Sir Francis Matters, Sir Brian Swift and Sir George Wilson. But there are others who are equally as distinguished. From this group of South Australians who went, Sir Henry Newland, Sir Ivan Jose and Sir Leonard Lindham were all presidents of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. Sir Charles Blackburn was the foundation president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. My grandfather was the first president of the Australasian College of Radiologists. And Gilbert Brown was the first president of the Australian Society of Anaesthetists. These were serious performers. True to form, when war was declared, effectively a large slab of the Department of Surgery at the Adelaide Hospital joined up. And here's a group of them from, again, Virko and Lemessurier in the back, who are second year residents, or as we would call them now, second year house surgeons. And in the front, Sir Henry Newland, Major Powell, a Victorian Bryant, Cor Bryant was the CO, Sir George Wilson and John Corbin. That fellow is an administrative officer who I'm sure is very important, but the others are in that. The one who's missing is Professor Watson, who is the Professor of Anatomy here at the University of Adelaide, and his stomping ground was not more than 100 feet from us tonight, or one of his stomping grounds. And if we run out of things to do, I can spend the rest of the evening telling stories about Professor Watson. I'm going to talk about a few people who intrigued me for a whole lot of different reasons. Now, if you had had any of the other authors talking about our book this evening, they would have selected a completely different group. And I think there's a message there, and that's that we can all find our heroes, our different heroes, for different reasons in our book. The first one I'm going to talk about is Watty. Professor Watson was the charismatic professor of anatomy here at the University of Adelaide. Watty had been a blackbirder as a youth. He'd trained overseas when he skipped bail, and then came back to Adelaide as the professor of anatomy. He also did a bit of surgery and had, during the Adelaide Hospital row when the medical school shut down, had served with the British forces in South Africa. Watty, at the age of 65, joined up and went with the number one Australian Stationary Hospital, the ones of whom I showed you that picture a few minutes ago, went with them to Egypt. Seems if he probably stayed in Egypt when that unit went on to Lemnos and then later to Gallipoli. And in 1916, Watty came back to Adelaide. He was encouraged to come home, and Howes, who was the boss in field at the time, wrote, "He's a very charming man, but his presence has a very bad influence on the younger men of any unit." He was regarded as a bit of a hero to both sides of my family. Henry Kenneth Fry, to my mind, is probably one of the smartest ones that went. Educated at Prince's, he was top student in final year at the University of Adelaide in medicine, a Rhodes Scholar. He then went on really to cover a whole range of different areas, and you can see from his qualifications there, he's an anthropologist, he's a scientist, he's a physician, psychiatrist, pharmacologist, and his DSO was for supervising the extraction of the wounded under fire at Pozieres in 1916, so about 100 years ago this month. Now, I'm just going to cover these fairly briefly. John Lemessurier Kneebone, he was educated at Saints, University of Adelaide, and was top student. In September 1914, he was described as having been killed in action in France. And I think I've just put Kneebone in to illustrate the problems of communication. So he was regarded as having been killed. There you are, Adelaide University graduate killed. And interesting enough, he was serving with the British forces, which made me wonder why he was wearing an Australian uniform. But that was just one of those things that I picked up. Because the British went as lieutenants, doctors went as lieutenants, the Australians went as captains. So there he is in Australian uniform, having been killed in France. But in fact, that wasn't so. So a few days later, it's reported that he's alive and well. Kneebone had, like Dr. Lomax Smith and a number of other people, including me, had done some of his training at the London Hospital. The London Hospital in the East End of London is associated with the London Hospital Medical College, the oldest medical school in Britain. The London Hospital pops up in the lives of a lot of people. Sir Henry Newland did train there, Kneebone trained there, Dr. Lomax Smith trained there, I trained there. But so did Howard Florey, Hugh Cairns, Leonard Lyndon, all spent some of their time at the London Hospital. It's now the Royal London. Kneebone was interesting in that he was served with the British forces. He went to Gallipoli and was designated to be the last doctor to leave Cape Helles. So if the British got sprung in their evacuation of Gallipoli, Kneebone was detailed to remain behind and become a prisoner of the Turks. Then went on to fight in France. Isra again was graduated in 1913 from the University of Adelaide. He was second in the class and joined up with his best friend Stan Verko, and they joined up in October 1914. They joined No. 1 Australian Stationary Hospital and went initially to Egypt, then to Lemnos, and Fred had his appendix removed whilst he was on Lemnos, and then went on to Gallipoli, went on to France, where he was decorated with a DSO for collecting the wounded under fire. Later obtained an MD from the University of Adelaide and practised as a paediatrician. Reginald Blockley Lucas was in the same year as Fred Lemessurier, and he was serving with a British unit, as one did. He had been educated at Saints and graduating here in 1913. On the 3rd of July, when his unit rushed forward, the expression they use for a charge, he was with 35 and 37 brigades as they charged against the German lines on the Somme. He was believed to be a prisoner, and when the University of Adelaide wrote, as they did, and the University of Adelaide have these records, which I think are absolutely fascinating, Charles Hodge, the registrar, wrote to presumably all of the members of the Senate of the university, because every graduate became a member of the Senate in those days, not so much now. And so basically what this memo says is, tell us about your boy. What's he up to? And this one is the one for Dr. Wayne Smith, who appears in our book, and there's a tiny little answer in that. And some of the answers are more detailed. Lucas's mother's answer, and here's another picture of Lucas in the graduating class of 1913, Fred Lemessurier, Harry Knott, who I'll mention later, and then the top student there. So the university have Mrs. Lucas's letter, and it's difficult to read at the best of times. Some of you in the front might be able to read it. I have great difficulty reading it at any time. They have the letter, and basically what it says is that they believe that Reginald Blockley Lucas was captured by the Germans on the 3rd of July 1916. We now know that he was killed on that day, and he's one of the very large number who have no known grave, presumably blown to bits. And so his mother, 5 months later, really is completely oblivious as to what happened to him. And so when you saw the British Prime Minister go to the Tietveld Memorial to the Missing at the beginning of July, Lucas's name is there on the memorial. Hugh Cairns is not a product of Saints or Princes, where most of them were educated. He's a product of Adelaide Boys High School at the University of Adelaide. He joined up at the age of 18 and went to Lemnos as a medical orderly. He was sent back to complete his medical career, which he did, and then he went back as Captain Cairns to France as a regimental medical officer. Of course, when he went back as a Rhodes Scholar, and his military file is full of correspondence saying that Captain Cairns, if he doesn't come back to Australia with the returning Australian troops, then he must pay his own way home. and the Master of Balliol guarantees Cairns will get back to Australia. Well, of course, he doesn't come back to Australia until he gets an honorary MD from this university in 1948. In the meantime, he goes to Oxford, trains at the London in the East End, and then back to Oxford as the first professor of surgery in the last trillion years, and is a neurosurgeon. He's a neurosurgeon to Lawrence, T. Lawrence, when Lawrence comes off his motorbike. And that has such an impact on him that when he's Brigadier Cairns, as you see him there in World War II, he insists that dispatch riders wear a helmet. Dispatch riders in North Africa wear a helmet. And as a consequence, the number of penetrating head injuries just went down. And I guess it's the reason that we encourage people to wear a helmet when they ride a bike or a motorbike to this day. He was also Unity Mitford's neurosurgeon. He was the first neurosurgeon, because obviously he's a Rhodes Scholar a couple of years behind Florey. He's the first, and professor of surgery at Oxford, and Florey's professor of pathology. He's the first surgeon, neurosurgeon, to give penicillin in the treatment of head injuries. Again, bloke who was educated at Saints, who was a Rhodes Scholar, and there seemed to be to me, that you could get a Rhodes Scholarship halfway through your medical course here, and then you go to Oxford and finish it. And that's what Maury was a Rhodes Scholar. He didn't matriculate in Oxford because the war started and he went straight into the army. He eventually got promoted, was decorated with a military cross at the Battle of Loos, and then joined the Royal Flying Corps. Early in January 1918, he was flying above France and collided with a German albatross and fell 8,000 feet to his death. He too has no known grave, and his name appears on the Flying Services Memorial in Arras in France. Now, when we couldn't fill a whole page, we did what I've described earlier as put in fillers and boxes, which we got bits from the BMJ, the MJA, and the diaries of John Corbin and Harry Knott. And I'll just give you some of the flavour of this. There's quite a bit of it in our book because we couldn't fill a whole page for everyone. For example, the war started on the 4th of August, London time, 5th of August, our time. And so really within a couple of days, the British Medical Journal is laying down the law as to what's expected of doctors. The bit in which I think this is actually amusing, so there you are, you've got to join up and do your thing, is the bit down the bottom. The country has to meet a situation such as it has never before been called upon to face, for events move less swiftly in the Napoleonic Wars, which were 99 years earlier. Well, we're talking about World War I, which is 100 years ago. They were doing precisely the same thing 100 years ago. So there would have been people around whose fathers had served in the Napoleonic Wars at the time of the start of World War I. BMJ is about business, of course, as much as anything else. It's saying that the doctors have joined up in large numbers. It's a good thing. However, if you're looking after somebody's practice, you must keep a separate set of accounts, and when that person returns from their military duties, you're to hand the patients back to them. The same appeared in the Medical Journal of Australia and in the local South Australian branch of the British Medical Association minutes, where Sir Joseph, or Joseph Verco as he was then, wrote these sort of long rambling essays about how you need to look after the practice of those who are serving overseas, and when they come back again, you're not to sort of steal their patients. The British Medical Journal really haven't done much about the anniversary of the start of World War I, and it's a bit narrow-minded of them, because as you see here, they're actually spelling it out. These are editorials in the British Medical Journal. They're spelling out what the duties of doctors are. And so as far as I can tell, they're in it up to their eyeballs. One of the things that those of us who have a military background will know is that it's very important to know what to take when you go somewhere. You know, what's the local arrangement? Well, here you have in January 1915 what you should take to France when you go. Obviously, a sword was not required, not a revolver, and I can quite understand why you wouldn't do that, but two suits of pyjamas, some bedroom slippers, and what have you. It goes on, but it's amusing, but the same thing happens today. when our troops go overseas, there are messages that come back. Now, obviously, with the internet and things are typed out, it doesn't appear in the in a medical journal, but nonetheless, it did in 1915. The BMJ had two South Australian columns each year. We don't know who wrote them. So this is one that appears on the 16th of January 1915, almost certainly was written a couple of months earlier. And we can see here, from this date, we've sent or ascending Ramsay Smith, the city coroner, who had generated some heat after he'd been appointed here to break the Adelaide Hospital row. Professor Watson, Majors Powell, Simpson, Newland, German, Corbin, T.G. Wilson, so these are the surgeons. Goldsmith had served in Montenegro, Captains Lemessurier, Verco, Kavanagh, Mannering, Pitcher, Michael Knott, Jeffries, Fry, the ex-Rhodes Scholar, and Bell's is not a South Australian. It's Betts. It's an old-fashioned spelling mistake. And now for those of you who think anything has changed, and when I prepared this slide some time ago or dug it out for the book, we were going through one of our many droughts here in South Australia, and I thought, here you are, nothing has changed since 1914, and I guess one doesn't really expect it to. So shower baths only in the summer of 1415. John Corbin had joined No. 1 Australian Stationary Hospital as a surgeon, and that hospital really was treating infectious diseases, and surgeons really don't like treating infectious diseases. It's all a bit beneath them. They want to go cutting things up. So John Corbin, as he says here, changed to another unit, and he changed to the 1st Australian Casualty Clearing Hospital, which landed at Gallipoli on Anzac Day. Original Anzac Day. So he moved to a surgical unit and went for it. And here is his report in the Medical Journal of Australia in 1916. So there you are. You can see really when he says during the first 4 days, 3,300 wounded passed through our hands, that's clearing out the Adelaide Hospital at night by boat every night for 4 nights. So That's really quite an achievement. And to do that under fire, of course, is even more of an achievement. Corbin says all the right things in the Medical Journal of Australia, but true to form, he kept a diary. And his diary is subtly different. And of course, his diary is in the War Memorial, and the Corbin family very kindly made the diary available to us, or a copy of the diary available to us, and bits of that appear in our book. And it's not completely different, but it is subtly different. And he didn't like all of his colleagues as much as perhaps he ought to have. This again is from the BMJ, that when one expects the doctors to be some distance behind the scene of action, that's not quite true. So in 1914, remember the war started on the 4th of August 1914. Now this is for the Indians, the Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians, the British, of course. And so 46 medical officer deaths in 1914, 97 in 1915. The consultant medical officer deaths are few in number, which is a good thing, of course. Medical students, now they didn't know a lot of the medical students who went, and the sons of medical men likewise. But clearly there was quite a significant death toll. As you know, for Australians who served in Australian units in World War I, 2/3 were killed or injured. And so that's about 66,000 deaths amongst the Australians in World War I. Now, in our book, these are the people who died or killed in action. There are two that I'd just like to bring to your attention. One of them is John Chute Ellis. Now, very early in the war, both amongst the British and the Australians, there were doctors who served as soldiers, and they had a very high mortality rate, and Chute Ellis is one of them. He didn't get a medical position, so he went into a fighting unit and was killed in action. Burden was killed in an accident in London, in action, and Blockley Lucas in action, Maury in action, and so on. So the death rate wasn't that 2/3 death rate that's 67,000 out of 360,000 death rate that you got with the other Australian troops, so they didn't die at quite the same rate, but nonetheless, it wasn't as if it was an easy run for all of them. Now, finally, just before I take questions, I'd just like to point out this painting. This painting is on the front of our book. The painting is by Septimus Power. It was given to the Art Gallery of South Australia by one of the doctors in the book, Dr. Bollen. And somewhat perversely, the first house that we moved into on the corner of Fitzroy Terrace and Prospect Road was the Bollen's house. So we my parents and with their children, obviously moved in there. And I've lived in the house where this painting originally was hanging before it was donated to the Art Gallery of South Australia. That part of Fitzroy Terrace is sort of knee-deep in doctors. The Barlows, who are in the book, Dr. Barlow lived next door, and across the other side of Prospect Road, Dr. Verco lived, my grandfather. So there were a whole string of them in a row at that point of intersection of Prospect Road and Fitzroy Terrace. Now, that's really covered what I had planned to cover, and hopefully more or less on time. And I'm happy to take some questions, but I'm going to ask Colonel Summers, who's a co-author, and Colonel Jelly, who's a co-author. Colonel Summers is professorial fellow of nursing and midwifery at Flinders, and is a colonel in the Royal Australian Army Nursing Corps, and Colonel Michael Jelly from the Royal Australian Army Medical Corps and formerly Chief Medical Officer for South Australia, to join me to help me answer the questions.
I had an opening question. I think you just said that one of these doctors couldn't get a medical position. Was that an oversupply or how come? I would have thought they wouldn't be very hesitant to...
This was John Shute Ellis. The Ellis family were rich in the southeast, owned most of it, I think, at some stage or other. They also had properties on the Hay Plains, three of them, and they had properties in New Zealand, so they were pretty disgustingly rich. And John Shute Ellis went back to England and did his medicine over there and graduated, then came back to Australia, didn't do medicine here, went and managed his properties out on the Hay Plains. And when the war broke out, he went back to England and he tried to get a job at the London Hospital. And they told him, go away, we don't want to know you. So he joined the artillery. And he lasted until 1917 before he got killed in action. Lieutenants in arms units were one of the highest rates of deaths in the military in World War One.
Just wait for the mic.
Thank you for your presentation. It was fantastic. Maury, if he was a doctor, what was he doing up in an aeroplane?
He was not a doctor. He was a medical student. So he was a medical student here for the first couple of years of his medical course. He got a Rhodes Scholarship and went to finish his medical degree at Oxford. And because the war broke out, he didn't actually enrol or matriculate, is the word they use. He didn't enrol in Oxford and went straight into the army. So we class him as one of our medical students. Look, when you get to do the definitions, you can do anything you like. But we class him as one of our medical students, and I think the University of Adelaide do too. Yes. So his class is our medical student, but he was not a doctor. He never finished his medical course. He didn't matriculate. He didn't complete it at Oxford University. It's where Rhodes Scholars goes, you know.
Again, thank you. Absolutely fascinating. After the Second World War, we saw huge advances in the treatment of burns and amputations, etc., as a result of the war. When these surgeons came back, did they bring back with them huge advances in their surgical skills? Was it noted? I mean, did they come back and really break some barriers?
Look, everything advanced really very quickly during World War One. And Jane has sent me a link to the Wellcome Museum. But everything, surgery, radiology, plastic surgery, neurosurgery, anaesthesia, blood transfusion, the treatment of infected wounds, it all changed very quickly. And a lot of it is there in the British Medical Journal, as people wrote. One of the things that intrigues me about the BMJ is there's a whole lot in the British Medical Journal which I think we would now regard as medical incompetence for security purposes, so that you actually have the a medical advantage in treating the injured. Interesting enough, the Germans leaked as much as the British did. We know, for example, it's in the book that the Germans have set up a 20,000 bed hospital in Berlin. The Germans were actually treating wounds with carbon, you know, with charcoal. You know, they knew what was happening on both sides.
You told me to tell you.
Oh, right, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to add to that, because it wasn't only in medical and surgical advancement, it was also on how we looked after patients. And in fact, World War One saw really the beginning of the hospitalisation of patients, because they were so used to having 1,000 patients to look after. So when, if you think about South Australia, there was a big flurry of little hospitals, the Gamaraka War Memorial Hospital, all over South Australia, and all of a sudden medicine realised that it was much easier to put all their patients there and get nurses to look after them, and they visited rather than doing all these home visits. So that was a big change in society as well from World War One. Michael wants to say something.
Part of the army principles are great coats on, great coats off. A lot of the time these people were sitting around doing not much, and they often went over to England and did additional training in England. And after the war, because not everyone could leap on a boat at the end of 1918, they went back and got further education in England. And Chris mentioned the fellow who had to pay his own way home. If you got a leave to go and study and you were going to go home in a year, you had to give a written undertaking that you were going to go home in a year, and if you didn't, you paid. So there was a lot of education came out of it for Australians while the war was on.
Can I just say there's some fantastic quotes in our book from the BMJ, and this one's from Sir William Osler, who was the Professor of Medicine at Oxford in 1914. "What I wish to urge is a true knowledge of your foes, not simply of the bullets, but of the much more important enemy, the bacilli. In the wars of the world, they have been as Saul and David, the one slaying thousands, the other tens of thousands."
Congratulations to all of you for what I think is a fabulous resource. A comment and a question. I noticed when reading Olive Haynes's diaries, when we were here, or we were here too, mm-hmm. She mentions Professor Watson quite often as somebody who was in Egypt in early 1915 and who was terribly solicitous to these nurses who were there in a foreign land and a little bit stranded and what have you, and chaperoned them round and took them to tea at Groffy's and all sorts of things. Yes, that's right. You
know, he was single.
Yes, I know. It's quite, I mean, I didn't know much about him, but I think having heard a little bit, it's quite interesting to contrast that with the way she describes him. My question is, as one who does collective biography and has looked at World War One nurses in some detail, I wonder whether in putting together these individual stories, you were possibly struck by similarities now, and differences and patterns. Now, Christopher, you mentioned a couple, like they all went to Saints, or most of them went to Saints or PAC. Were there other dimensions in their lives that were similar or different, or that would help the next generation of researchers think, oh gosh, that's interesting, I'll look at that?
It did seem to me that most of them, not all, but most of them came from a long line of doctors. I mean, they all came from medical families in the main. And the other thing that struck me is they were all very intelligent. The majority of them came top in their class or top in this or got this sort of scholarship or that sort of scholarship. So there was that. They were a very intelligent group of young men.
There weren't many places to actually matriculate for the university, and Saints and Princes were the main ones that people were matriculating from. There were a few high school ones. There was the very odd Catholic one, like Britton Jones, who went through Wakefield Street. but most of the people who were matriculating, and some of those had only been at Saints or Princes for a year or two, and the purpose was to get matriculated.
Just another little thought there too, and the other thing that really struck, I think we discussed this, so many of them came from country towns, and the doctors. It wasn't like they weren't all centred in Adelaide. Yes, they came to Adelaide to university, but many of them, they came from all over South Australia, and I think that's something that we don't see today, but it was quite widely dispersed, many of them.
I'd also like to mention that the University Cricket Club and Football Club have a joint project at the moment to recognise these men, and hopefully by Remembrance Day 2017 we'll have a picket fence between the grandstand and the scoreboard with plaques remembering these fine men.
Thank you very much indeed. That's one of the two parts that, if I can make two comments. One of the interesting things is the Prince's guys obviously all played lacrosse. The majority in the book of Prince's old scholars, and they played lacrosse, and so the whole lot of them that got a half blue for lacrosse, which is interesting. So don't exclude lacrosse from the obvious ones of from the obvious ones of cricket, football, and rowing. Rowing was the other one. The second comment I think that I can pick up with that is that one of the books that I had read, because these two were involved in raising money for the Simpson and Donkey statue, which is just across the river from us, and as part of the sort of the periphery of that, not in the group, but the periphery of it, I was reading things at the time. And one of the really saddest books I think that's ever been produced in Australia is The Role of the Members of the Melbourne Cricket Club Who Were Killed in World War One. And I really defy anyone to read more than a page and a half at a time. And they're actually just a paragraph. You know, captain of the boats at such and such a school killed somebody or other. Captain of the first 18 killed somebody or other. These were absolutely the cream of Australian sporting prowess, I think. You know, great schools, great universities, and they're all in this wretched book, which has, you know, hundreds of names in it. It's a very, very sad book.
A very specific question. My own doctor's name is Britton Jones, so that's already a sort of interesting. I had no idea he presumably had some relationship to
all
one of the names
tell
you mentioned.
You they're all related. Yeah. Not all workers. Everybody's a worker.
But I noticed that one of the other names had Britton in the middle of it. Is that just a
It's a Burden. I don't think he's related to the Britton Jones. There's Clive Britton Burden, who was killed in a traffic accident in London. I don't think he's related.
He's the one that fell in front of the
Fell in front of a mechanised omnibus. It's
very
a bit unclear.
Sad. Fell in front of a train
at the train station. Taken to St George's and had all sorts of things. Hyde Park corner and had all sorts of things.
Britton Jones, like other South Australian names like Bar Smith, etc., don't put a hyphen between them. And that's because that's not their whole surname. And they often use their maternal surname with their paternal surname and then join them. But they didn't put a hyphen in there. And Britton Jones was one of those. But yes, you're right, there's at least three other doctors with Britton Jones I know of.
Just to add to that, I'm an English person, and there's the one thing that really struck me, and even with our current book, it's the same thing. So many people, for their second name, took their mother's maiden name or their grandparents' maiden name to maintain that name. And that was very interesting for me to see.
Any other questions?
It's at the printers.
Do you want to just?
Yes, because we got a little bit bored afterwards. We weren't ever going to do it again because that took probably 4 years. So this last September, we were assured that if we did Vietnam, doctors who went to Vietnam, it would be really easy and it wouldn't take long, and. But what happened was it wasn't enough. There are 41 South Australian doctors who served in Vietnam, one sitting here in the audience. And so we, our new book covers from the signing of the surrender on the Missouri to Vietnam. So all South Australian doctors who served on active service, and we have to use that term, from the end of World War II until Vietnam, 1945 to 1975. It's been great. I suppose nearly, I was going to say three quarters, but not quite three quarters of the people in the book are still alive. And we have had a lovely time getting in touch with all of these people. They've written a lot of their own story, which we've edited. And if they haven't, then their relatives or their daughters, as like there is someone else in this audience that did, has supplied us with all the information so that we can write this new book. And it's at the printers that we at the moment. It will be called Blood, Sweat and Fears 2. And medical practitioners from South Australia who served from after World War II to Vietnam, 1945 to 75. So we haven't even thought about World War II yet. We know that there's at least 300 army doctors. I think there's going to be about 400 altogether if you talk Navy and Air Force. So that'll be for a younger group, we think.
It looks like we're just about to get shut down. Can I just say our book is for sale outside. None of the authors derive any benefit from the book because we're a subgroup of the Army Museum of South Australia. The money all goes to them. And our books are $20 each. Cash, buy up, yes. Buy early, buy often.
Yes. Well, look, I'd like to thank Christopher and Annette and Michael for such an incredibly interesting evening, as your questions indicate. Certainly, as I say, when I next see my doctor, I will have quite an interesting conversation. And it's been extremely interesting to see the relationship of so many of these names to the university. As a thank you, we don't actually have a gift to present, but we're looking forward, and I was very pleased with your opening remark about dinner. Great, is how you put it. So we are looking forward to taking our speakers to dinner, which will be covered by one of our sponsors, the Mantra Hotel. I'd like to thank other sponsors, Coriol Vineyards for the wines, which I'm sure you've all enjoyed, and also, of course, Wakefield Press. And one of the tasks, if you like, for you, Christopher, is to draw the door prize, which is a Wakefield Press gift voucher for the lucky person. So Jane will get you.
Very exciting, this.
Blue B60. Who's got it? Anyone got it? Oh, well done. Yeah. Excellent. Here's the prize.
All right. Yeah.
And I just say put the Germans to work.
All right. Thank you. Well, look, that really brings me to a few announcements. A lot of you are members of the Friends, but if you're not, we'd love you to join, and I think there are some membership flyers available, and there's no membership fee. If you join, then you'll get information about our events, and there are a few other benefits. Now, we've got a couple more events to announce. On the 18th of August, we've got an event with the Nobel Prize winner, Peter Doherty. Some of you will know of his reputation. And he'll be speaking on the knowledge wars. That won't be in this room. That will be over in Napier Room 101 or something like that. But you'll get instructions for the event if you'd like to join or if you look for the announcements on the library website. The Theatre Guild, the University of Adelaide Theatre Guild, gives a concession to Friends, and they're production of The Crucible opens on the 6th of August. I think that covers my stuff, but I'd like to hand over to Jane, and we're glad you were able to join us, Jane, because I think you'd like to say a few words on some matters.
Yeah. Yes, I think that this is a really significant week for many of us who have a history, an interest in history, or have relatives, or we're related to someone involved in the First World War, and so many of us have been. There are exhibitions as well that I would recommend to you. We've had a fabulous introduction to this book, and I do hope you buy it, because it's actually incredibly cheap and it's absolutely fascinating. So please do buy this book. Perhaps we'll have another session for number two in the coming year, because I think these are subjects that we're all interested in, particularly at this moment. Of course, Wakefield have a few books outside, and you have to support Wakefield as well, because they are really important to this state. So please spend some money with Wakefield. But the exhibitions that I would really recommend, one of them is in this building. Please go down to the first floor. Outside the rare books collection on the first floor, there is the most amazing display of memorabilia from the First World War. It's from a private collector who never lets anyone see his material. And this has everything that people took to the front. It's got equipment from the medical corps. It's got material from nurses. It's got Samilon memorabilia from the Welcome Home Hut. And it's got a whole range of material from Europe as well, some of it in French. It is quite extraordinary. I don't think I've ever seen a collection like it, even in places like the Imperial War Museum. Please get to see that. It's only open for another 10 days or so. There's another amazing exhibition in the museum, which is really exciting. It's about Aboriginal diggers. And as you know, many Aboriginal people went to the First World War when they weren't described as Australian citizens. They'd already been to the Boer War, and some of them were refused re-entry because they weren't white Australians and they had to stay overseas after the First World War. Most of them were allowed back after the First World War. And there are stories about individuals from South Australia who fought. One particular story was about an Aboriginal man who was taken by the Germans, put into a camp. And they were always interested in anthropology and ethnography. And they sent a Jewish scientist to interview him, they did to all the Commonwealth non-white combatants that they caught. He recorded the information from him from a cultural point of view. And then when the Second War came, he left just before Kristallnacht and came to Melbourne, where he taught in the university and re-established a relationship with this Aboriginal soldier. So it's an amazingly poignant story. Please go. It's the little gallery on the first floor of the South Australian Museum, an excellent exhibition as well. So I know we're not celebrating, but it is an important time to remember, and I thank our speakers, all of whom have worked so hard to produce this amazing book. Please buy it, and we'll see you in August. Thank you.